Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
Right, it's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to, the show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here.
Hey, Joe, what do you know?
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we do that, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
Okay, once again, I want to welcome all my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. My thanks to my good friend Ben Birch for hosting my archives there. Also, my listeners at rantradio.com and cadronpictures.com. As I speak, it is Saturday evening, 8:53 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I'm getting this show prepared for tomorrow. Feels like Sunday. I know it really doesn't make any difference what day it is as far as just the sunrise and sunset is concerned, but you know how sometimes days feel like other days. Today is a Saturday, but it feels like Sunday, and I have to go to work again day after tomorrow. I've just had a week off in which I finished a really nice interview with Take Back the Media, but it was with Don Waller for Take Back the Media, but for some reason, the new Take Back the Media show, as I speak, at least the last time I checked, has not shown up on his website. And I'm not sure what's going on there, because I put the show up very late Wednesday, hoping to get it on before his show came on. And I was expecting it to come on Thursday or Friday at the latest, but here it is Saturday evening, and it's still not there. So I really don't know what the deal is with that. And I wish Mr. Waller would email me or let me know. I've emailed him to say, what's the deal? Why hasn't the new Take Back the Media show, the one with your interview, come on your site? So I really don't know what the hell is going on with that there. And let me double check while I'm here at the website. I might as well double check and see, because they really should have had that show on. There has been a lively discussion on the message board in the comment section of the blog about different things other than politics. And I'll talk about that in another segment. But first I want to talk about something. No, it's still not here. The last show they have is 43. And 44 is supposed to be the one where they play the clip, which is funny because if they do it before the show gets on the air, and they're probably people aren't going to see it, If they put it up here later tonight or tomorrow, by tomorrow night, the Don Waller interview will not be there. So I don't know what to do about that. I've waited, you know, I'm not going to wait anymore to put the shows up, because I'm going to put the shows up. That's what I want to do. But at any rate, we'll see how that comes, and I'll, in another segment of this show, or at the very least on the next show, I will have some information regarding that. Now, anyway, what I really wanted to talk about in this segment was something that happened yesterday, I believe it was. And there was a debate between Ralph Nader and Howard Dean. And I really only caught the last 30 minutes of it. And actually, I've been trying to find an MP3 of it. If any of you out there have an MP3 or know where I can get one via a website somewhere, an actual MP3, I don't want to stream it. I want the actual thing, because I'd like to play clips from it. Just email me, joevec@bellsouth.net, and you can attach it as a file, and I can pick it up. And I only caught the last half an hour or so of it. And you know, Ralph Nader looked tired. He looked old and tired. He really did, and he was like he was under just too much stress and that he just needed to relax and take it easy. And the one thing I saw that Governor Dean jumped on him big time for about is that Ralph was a proponent of putting none of the above on the ballot, which is one of the most ridiculous things you can do. You know, nobody would vote for anybody. We'd never have, you know, in fact, we'd be stuck with the same group of politicians we've got now because nobody will ever want to change. So a vote for none of the above would be essentially a vote for the same cocksuckers that are in there right now. And it's just ridiculous. You got to have a choice. And I agree with Ralph on some things that we need to make some changes and we need to change some policies. But Jesus Christ, Ralph, that's just stupid. You know, if you can't get more people involved in politics above and beyond pushing a lever every couple of years or so, then no political system that's based on self-rule is simply going to work. You know, and I don't have a problem with a lot of the things that Ralph Nader says. I mean, I have a lot. I agree in the most part, for the most part, with a lot of the things he talks about, a lot of the changes that we need. I disagree that there is no fundamental change difference between the two parties, because there are fundamental differences. There are certain things that they are alike in. Yes, I'm not arguing or disputing that. They both have a problem with corruption and with corporate interests having too much control over them. The Republicans are far worse than the Democrats, but the Democrats have problems with it too. And I'm not saying they don't. But it takes more than just agreeing with Mr. Nader to make him a viable candidate. I mean, even if by some miracle, and I'll tell you something, a hand of God miracle is what it's going to take. That even if by some miracle Ralph Nader manages to pull this off and actually get elected, how the hell is he going to get anything done? He doesn't have any members of a party or organization that are going to be behind him to say, you know, to back him up and say, here we go, we will help you put your stuff together. Here's the stuff you sign, you know, or we'll put it in and we'll vote for it and we'll debate on it. And then we'll send it to you as a bill and you can sign it into law. He's going to have to fight both Republicans and Democrats. Republicans obviously hate his guts, although the Republicans are financing his campaign only because they know that they want to put they want to take a few more votes away from John Kerry. And any, you know, I can appreciate and understand the people who voted for Mr. Nader in 2000, and I understand that. But this is a different time, and he's got no real reason to run again. You shouldn't waste your vote on him now, because that will be not only a wasted vote but a dangerous vote. And Nader would only be successful if he was part of a larger organization that was capable of accomplishing the things that he's talking about. He can't do it by himself. Even the greatest president in this century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the most popular president ever, elected four times by huge margins, no controversies there, he could not do it alone. He needed the help of a huge group of people that basically worked for him in that sense, because they considered him their leader. And that was the New Deal liberal progressives. And that group took a long time to form. It didn't form overnight. Now, the Greens did not support Ralph Nader this year, which means the Greens will get probably about 0.5% instead of 2 or 3%. Nader was the only reason that they got any stuff at all. But the mistake was abandoning the Democrats rather than simply trying to take them over. And, you know, a few shows ago, I did a thing called Friggin' Libertarians. And, you know, now I'm going to do a thing called Friggin' Greens, because the fucking Greens are just stupid. And let me read you something from something I wrote way back in March of 2002. I believe that's right, March 2002. And this is some of the things I wrote. Let's be clear about one thing. The Green Party is a single-issue party that won't last 10 minutes after Ralph Nader decides to play in another sandbox, period. And that is proven to be true. Nobody gives a shit about the Green Party anymore. You hardly ever hear them mentioned, except for the fact that they wouldn't nominate him this time around. Actually, calling the Greens a political party isn't entirely correct. It's more like a personality cult. At least when I was talking about this, Ralph was still with the Green Party, but still. The Greens think they're well organized? Are they well funded? Let me tell you something. The Reform Party was better organized and funded than they ever have been. And look what happened to them after Ross Perot left. Now, while it's possible that someday the Greens might be powerful enough to truly play in the same national field as the Democrats and the Republicans, by the time that happens, the right wing will be so firmly entrenched that the votes won't matter because we won't be allowed to vote anymore anyway. So, faced with that, what should the Green people do? Should they give up? Should they get out of politics altogether? Of course not. The answer is simple, and it was right in front of you all that time. Take over the Democratic Party. As organized as you obviously are, and you are organized, you do know what you're doing to a certain extent, you'd be shocked at how easy that would be at the grassroots level. And even Michael Moore discussed that in his book, Dude, Where's My Country? Think of what you could accomplish if you had the resources of the Democratic Party, or at least put yourselves in the position where they would have to listen to you. Imagine forcing them to accept Nader as head of the EPA, where he would do far more good than he ever would as president. Imagine if you could force them to make your policies their policies. Imagine, if you will, the high you'd get from real power. But here's the hard truth that you guys are unwilling to accept. Here's the part that's going to piss you off royally. You don't want real political power. You wouldn't know what to do with it if you had it. Having real power would prevent you from all the fun you're having at your rallies and parties. You're just screwing around in politics because it seems like a cool thing to do out of college. It's a wonderful kegger where everyone's having a ball, but after it's all said and done, you'll have a mother of a hangover, and in this case, that hangover can be fatal. And if you look at the fact that they're bringing up the draft, guess what, people? You're not going to be exempt from it. A lot of you kids are of draftable age. Guess what? You know, you're only hurting the people you say you're trying to help. Lower middle class workers like myself who are struggling to get by and support our families. Your actions are allowing the real enemies of freedom to hold power they otherwise wouldn't and make our lives tougher. If the Republican Party gets the total power that they want, they'll crush you like flies and there won't be a damn thing you can do about it. And what makes you think the Democrats are going to be any nicer to you if they manage to recover and regain political power? Why should they be nice to you? You try to destroy them. In the end, by continuing to do what you do, there are only two results. You'll live in a world dominated by right-wing Republicans or a world dominated by centrist Democrats, neither one of whom has any reason to listen to you or to do anything to further your cause. And if you succeed in your stated goal of destroying your Democrats, what then? If you think you're going to be the ones to replace them, you're wrong. You don't have a broad enough policy to win that many voters over to your side. A Nader supporter in a message board rebuked me once for my insulting words and tried to point out all the hard work they've done on my behalf. Now, I agree that you're all working hard, but in the game of politics, it's results that count. There's no consolation prize for second place, people. And you guys don't even merit an honorable mention. How many Green senators are there? Congressmen, governors, mayors, city councilmen, school board members. What good is all that hard work you're doing? You are so busy trying to get one guy to be president that you don't understand that even getting him elected wouldn't help. A president without support is useless. You don't take over a system from the top down. You do it from the bottom up. That's what the right-wing fundamentalists did in taking over the Republican parties. While I despise them and all they stand for, I admire them for the way they have played the game and played it well, and now they can dictate terms to the party leadership. Hell, they are the party leadership. They accomplished their first major goal, getting Reagan nominated and elected in about 4 years of solid grassroots work led by people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. Are you trying to tell me that you're dumber than right-wing fundamentalists? Wake up. Grow up. There is victory only in unity. If you don't like the Democrats, fine. Hold your nose and vote for them anyway. If you're stupid enough to believe that there are no major differences between the parties, you deserve what you'll get. And I've got news for you right now. Like I said before, the odds are what you'll get is a foxhole in Iraq or Syria or Jordan or Lebanon or someplace. Now, that wouldn't be such a bad thing, personally, if the rest of the country wouldn't have to pay for it as well. In the meantime, you can redirect your energies towards taking over the Democrats from the ground up, and in less time than you think, you'll be able to dictate terms and maybe even claim the leadership of the party. Once you have the power, you can do something constructive. Until then, you need to quit undermining your own cause, which is the cause of freedom. And again, I want to point that out. And it's the same. I have the same kind of feelings with the Greens as I have with the Libertarians. And you know, the fucking Libertarians, for those of you if you're a libertarian and you're listening to this laughing that I'm yelling at the Greens, guess what? The Greens still are going to poll more than you in 2004. More people are still going to pull the lever for a green presidential candidate than a libertarian presidential candidate, especially the screwball that you put in to run. So don't be fucking kidding yourselves. And that's all I've got to say. It's not that I disagree with what you're wanting to do, at least as far as, you know, getting government back to the people and away from corporate interests. Hey, I'm all for that. But you got to do it the right way. You can't just go around and you know, just yell and scream all the time without doing anything that's really going to directly affect the politics. I mean, I'm not making any bones into thinking that I'm going to personally elect John Kerry president. Of course not. And I've heard somebody else say that anyone but Bush is a horrible policy, just as bad as the Republicans. And that's a bunch of bullshit. You do the best you can. It's politics. And how does that Rolling Stone song go? You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you get what you need. Anybody in politics who thinks they can get everything they want is fooling themselves. Even these Republicans, who have a lot more political power than you've ever imagined, can't get everything they want. And thank God for that. Thank God for our founding fathers and for the Constitution that they put together. Because if things were easy, if it was easy for them to have just taken over, they would have. But it's not easy. It's very difficult. And you people need to learn that lesson. Anyway, let's take a little break. And we'll be back with our friends from BuzzFlash.com.
We'll be right back with more of the Tapper Joe Radio Show.
Welcome back to the BuzzFlash.com GOP Hypocrite of the Week. John McCain asserts in a 2004 Bush-Cheney campaign ad that Bush has led with great moral clarity and firm resolve. The Chicago Tribune called it an impassioned testimonial from John McCain. That moral clarity stuff is pretty hard to swallow after Bush unleashed Karl Rove to slander in the most base and racist way McCain and his family during the 2000 South Carolina Republican primary. Karl and his gutter crawlers tossed everything at the New Hampshire GOP primary victor, including phone calls to voters implying McCain was the father of an illegitimate black child, and a whispering campaign that he was not really a Vietnam War hero after all. And these revolting smears were just for starters. So McCain knows that he's dealing with a man who leads a team that crawls through the sewer on a daily basis, a team of slanderers and liars. Maybe that's why McCain made this charge on the Bill Moyers show now. Bill Moyers said, "If you can't trust them, why can we?" And McCain responded, "I don't. I can't answer that, except to say that in 20 years around this town, I've never had people break their word to me in this fashion." There's much more that McCain knows about the despicable tactics of an administration without any ethical or moral compass, a White House that lies so brazenly it has become banal. But McCain took the route of the hypocrite and decided to become a Bush cartel team player and claim, with a straight face, that Bush is a man of moral clarity. That's like calling a toxic sludge dump a pristine lake. Of course, speculation is bubbling that Cheney might bow out of the ticket at the last minute for health reasons and be replaced with, well, John McCain as the Republican vice presidential candidate. We wouldn't dare to speculate that this might have anything to do with McCain supporting a man that defamed the Vietnam War hero and his family in the most vile of ways during the 2000 election. But even if the Cheney resignation scenario unfolded, John McCain wouldn't really be the vice president, just as Bush isn't really the president. The battery-operated Dick Cheney would still be sitting in the Oval Office pantry, whispering instructions to George W. on how to further bring this nation into a state of corporate crony ruin. That would be divine justice for our hypocrite of the week, John McCain. He would be nothing more than a figurehead vice president, as Cheney continued his role as Chairman of the Board of America Incorporated. Poor John. We always were polar opposites with him on social programs and war policy, but like many others, we thought that the man had some integrity. Now, we know he's just another Republican hack. And our 39th GOP Hypocrite of the Week. Until next week, remember the BuzzFlash slogan? So many Republican hypocrites, so little time. Catch up with you soon.
Hi, kids. George Lowe, voice of TV's beloved Space Ghost. You are barking a happy tune with my close personal friend, the lovely Joe Vecchio, on the Cup O' Joe radio show.
And we're back on the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, my URL is cupojoe.blogspot.com. And my email address is joevec@bellsouth.net, and I want to encourage everybody to write to me and to go onto the blog and make a comment in my comments section that I have there. Well, it's not really a section. Just after every little topic, they have a little thing that's run by Halo Scan, which is a very good group of people, and I actually paid them, I think it was like $10 for a year membership so that I can have unlimited size writing and be able to edit and delete stuff like that. So, well, I kind of could delete stuff anyway. I really don't generally do that, but every now and then if I get a troll that I think is particularly obnoxious, I will delete what they have to say. My wife is sitting here doing some stitchery work. She likes to do stitchery work. And she's sitting there in her underwear because she's hot. And, yeah, she's going through menopause, which means she gets serious hot flashes. And speaking of the comments section, an old friend of mine, who I'll just call Admiral Howard, real name I will not divulge, he's an old friend of mine. We actually did a little video together many years ago when I was based in Montana, when I was in the Air Force at Malmstrom. And he has recently surfaced and was surprised to find my show. And he's a right-winger, but that's not unusual for him. There's a lot of people out in Montana that are right-wingers. And he was admonishing me about talking only about politics. But, of course, this is a political show. And what's funny is that I get people who tell me that I need to talk more about politics and less about my personal stuff. And now I get people who tell me to talk about less about politics and more about my personal stuff. And, you know, quite frankly, it's my fucking show. I can't please everybody, you know. It's my fucking show. I'll do what I want. If you guys want to talk about stuff, you make your own fucking show, will you? Please. I'm not criticizing people for saying stuff like that, but you know, it when it comes right down to it, I really can't allow myself, and no radio show host can allow himself to let his audience tell him where to go, which way or the other. You know, I just got to be what I am, and if I'm not what I am, then I'm nobody. But this is how I am, and sometimes I'll talk about personal things, but generally in the context of, you know, work sucks. And why does work suck, and what's going on along those lines? And I have it luckier than most people. My job is fairly decent. It pays pretty well, although, to be honest, $12.50 an hour still really doesn't pay the bills. And, you know, my wife and I, we did a little buying this week. Nothing really fancy, nothing that you would call incredibly frivolous. For example, I bought a couple little knickknacks for her, a wolfy knickknack, because she loves wolves, and it was a little, like a ceramic type of deal, very small, cost like $9, and there was a little thing about what, it's like a little statuette of two mice, and one of them was holding this big wedding ring behind his back, and, you know, just a really cute little thing that my wife likes more than I do, but, you know, I encourage her in these sort of things from time to time, because, you know, frankly, it's nice, you know, to do nice things for your wife, and she hasn't had the opportunity to have nice things in her life. So I try to do the best I can for her in that sense. But, you know, we wound up spending not just on stuff for her, but for other things. We wound up spending like $100 or so, which is a lot of money. You know, and it seems to me ridiculous that a guy with a nice steady job who doesn't have that much rent to pay can feel like it's dangerous to spend like $100 on something. And I don't know what to say. You know, I mean, it just seems to me counterproductive to go to work. I mean, if I want to be broke, I could stay home all day and be broke. At least we have enough money to pay the bills. But it's not right that somebody should be working 40-plus hours a week, and actually 40 hours a week, and still just barely be able to get by. You know, in my father's day, and I know I'm sounding like the old bastard that I am when I say stuff like that, but in my father's day, a job like mine, paying a comparable salary to what everybody was making back then, and grant you, I'm making a little bit more than most people are making now, unless you're well-educated or in a really, really high-skilled job, but a salary like that would be more than capable of allowing you to not only live, but to save money and do things. With the money that you've earned. And here I am, I'm just barely making by. So I really don't know what I can tell everybody except that you got to go out and do the best you can. Anyway. Yeah, I'm just not happy about a lot of the things that are going on. And, you know, I had the thing about the Dean Nader thing, and I don't know what the hell's going to happen in this country. Things are so fucked up. Right now. Before I do anything else, let me pull a plug for my other show, Audio Hell, which I do live on Saturdays from 4 to 6. And the only reason I can do it live is because I don't really have a life. I generally tend to be home. Anyway, I'm a homebody, and I always really have been. Although I do like going out. My wife can attest to that. I like just getting out of the house and not even necessarily doing anything. But I do the show. It's on cammafia.com. And it's on Saturdays from 4 to 6, and it's my music show. Since I really, it's really, Rant Radio and others don't really like me to play the music here, and I can understand that. And since I've kept this thing down to an hour or so, I really don't play the music as much. I just do a lot more talking. And, you know, that's where I go to play my music, and it's a really big mix of different stuff. I play very little new stuff. I play mostly stuff from the 70s and 80s that, you know, I grew up with, and some from the 60s. A little bit of everything. Some show tunes. Yeah, I know show tunes. I'm not a homosexual, okay? I like show tunes. I like musicals. My wife and I both love to watch musicals. I like, what we would consider now to be classic rock. The only things I really don't play on my show are, like, classical and hip-hop. Stuff like that. Oh, I play comedy, too. Comedy bits and comedy songs. Novelty songs, as they used to be called. I played Kung Fu Fighting on my last show. And it's a live broadcast. I basically stream everything through. I think I really can do that with Rant Radio. But you know what? When I'm doing the talking show, I don't like to do it as much because I tend to ramble too much. Like I am now. Like I am now. Anyway. I want to take a little break here, actually. It's been a short segment, but I want to take a little break here. I've got a couple of things that I want to talk about. And to the people in the comments section, we started to talk about old comic strips and stuff like that. And that's really cool. I don't mind doing that so much. But really, the show here is mostly for politics. And if I talk about other stuff, it's going to be in the sense of how politics is affecting us or how we're affecting politics in that sense. Anyway... Let's have a little break, and we'll be back with more of the Cup of Joe radio show. And we're back. Joe Radio Show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, my URL is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and my email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. please email me. Let me know what you think of the show, or if you have any ideas or anything you would like me to talk about, or comment in the comment section on the blog. And again, that's cupojoe.blogspot.com. Now, I mentioned earlier, I believe, that my wife and I went and saw Spider-Man 2, which we both thought was a very good movie, and we enjoyed it incredibly. And there have been a lot of interesting takes on that. This week I saw that Spider-Man again was not on top, and it's really raking in the money, doing very, very well. And Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 11 dropped down to number 4, making about $20 million, which is still a fairly decent amount because that's about what it was making. Only the fact that Spider-Man opened up, basically, and everybody knew that was going to be a big hit anyway. Nobody knew exactly how big it was going to be, but we knew it was going to be big. Fahrenheit 9/11 has now reached the $80 million mark. And there was an article in the New York Times comparing that with Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, which you can say is the conservative Republican thing for that. And, of course, that made over $300 million. Of course, it was on a lot more screens, and it had a star of really big note behind it, Mel Gibson. It got much more publicity. But also, there are a lot more very fundamentalist religious people in this country, and also people who are just religious in general, like my wife, who wanted to see the film and wanted to see his vision of it. And while our government, by necessity, must be as secular as possible, because you can't establish a state religion, or you can, but that basically screws things up for everybody else. There are a lot of people in this country who consider themselves Christians, much more than who consider themselves liberals, unfortunately, although the two don't necessarily have to be separate. There are liberal Christians, certainly, but none of them are hardcore fundamentalists. Liberal Christians and the rightchristians.org has a good mix of them. They tend to be a little bit more Christ-like. They're more of the peaceful Christ as opposed to the warrior Christ. But that's not what I want to talk about. There was an article in the New York Times today by A.O. Scott talking about the two movies and how they've and why they become as popular. I mean, granted, the 9/11 Fahrenheit 9/11 isn't anywhere near as popular as Passion of the Christ was. However, for an R-rated documentary, it is unbelievable in its popularity. It really wasn't expected to be that popular. Nobody in the big industry anyway thought about that. And one of the reasons, according to the article, is that these are movies that actually go out and try to tell a tale from a particular point of view rather than just being a timid makeover. I mean, how many movies have you seen lately that are just basically takeoffs of something else, or you're just totally based on a book, or just and TV series are the same way. Nobody can seem to think of anything friggin' original to say anymore. And to make movies. I remember Norman Jewison, when he won the Lifetime Oscar. Norman Jewison, the great, great Hollywood producer for many years. He got his Oscar and he said, you know, I wish people would just tell stories. Because that's really what it's all about, telling stories. And unfortunately, too much of the industry is geared toward let's make a quick buck. And you see examples of that. I mean, they've been showing the Rocky movies on, AMC, I think, over the last week or so, weekend. And you know, the first Rocky movie is an awesome, brilliant movie, one of the best movies ever made, in my opinion. And there are reasons that it was great. And one of the reasons it was great was that Rocky lost the fight at the end. And and of course, you know, the studios were scared about this movie. Oh, and it turned out to be a big hit. And I don't know how many times that's happened, that studios were scared about something like that, and it turns out to be a big hit. Obviously, it doesn't always happen. If it always happened, I'm sure they would rethink their policies on that. But there's a lot of times where studios were just afraid of something because it was something new. Then, of course, when it became popular, you had Rocky II, Rocky III, Rocky IV, Rocky V. And now they're talking about doing a Rocky VI, believe it or not. And as far as I'm concerned, well, Rocky III was kind of cute because it had the whole Hulk Hogan thing and the Mr. T thing. And it was kind of neat. But really, there was no need for any of the other movies. There was no need for them. And if Rocky hadn't been, you know, popular, obviously, they never would have made them. But the only reason they made them was because, you know, the first one made money. And if they'd had a real plan for it, I mean, George Lucas, when he did Star Wars, he actually did have a plan for 9 different movies. Unfortunately, only the first two were any good. The third, Return of the Jedi sucked, I thought. Well, it didn't suck, but it was nowhere near the caliber of the first two. The second one, Wrath of Khan, that was a Star Trek. What am I thinking? Empire Strikes Back is still my favorite of all the Star Wars movies. But Lucas already had this envision. He didn't know how popular Star Wars was going to be, but it took everybody by surprise. Excuse me. Professional show business, ladies and gentlemen. Let me get a little water here. I've been a good boy taking my water. I don't drink soda anymore. I'm off the Mountain Dew. I have to be off the Mountain Dew because my blood sugar was getting a little too high. And it's still a little high. Anyway, let me go back to... Hang on. Let me drink. Let me drink. Will you let me drink? Will you get off my case and let me drink? Thank you. The things you gotta do. There's nobody even here to bug me. My wife is sitting there. She's getting ready to fall asleep because she's tired. She takes a lot of medicine, too. But anyway, my point is that they're always making sequels. And to quote something from the article here, he says, perhaps more than ever before, the movie studios are ruled by timidity, anxiously tailoring their releases to avoid giving offense. Yes, they sometimes engage in the mock provocations of sex and brutality, but these tepid buttons are pushed much less forcefully than they were 30 years ago. For the most part, movies intent on maintaining an illusion of consensus tread cautiously around the thornier thickets of our civic life. Homosexuality no longer needs to be euphemized out of existence, though it's best not to place too much emphasis on the sex part. But abortion can scarcely be mentioned. War can be depicted with unvarnished savagery, but also with lump-in-the-throat speeches about valor and sacrifice, and also with period costumes to camouflage any uncomfortably topical implications. The social injustices of the past are ringingly opposed and soundly defeated, enforcing the view that the present is a land of eternal sunshine. Above all, the local multiplex follows the code of an old-line country club in which religion and politics are not to be discussed. The justification, as always, for this kind of bland cowardice is economic and follows a marketing logic that's hard to refute. Why risk alienating potential customers? But the movie-going public can be alienated just as much by boredom as by distaste, and it may be that the studios should be more afraid of our indifference than of our anger. At the moment, we are in a state of spiritual and political agitation, and while we may still be looking for an entertainment to distract us or calm us down, we also clearly have an appetite for entertainment that does the opposite, that focuses our attention and raises our blood pressure. We worry about the health of the body politic and the state of our immortal souls, and at least some of us, some of the time, we want a culture that responds to these concerns. In other words, we are willing to pay good money to be provoked, engaged, enraged, exalted, and challenged. Now, this is not too different from what somebody was talking about with the Spider-Man movie and comparing how Spider-Man dealt with things in Spider-Man 2 as opposed to how George Bush deals with things. The strength of Spider-Man 2 is the fact that Peter Parker is a reluctant hero. He does things... I mean, he enjoys swinging around and stuff like that, but he really does the things he does because he feels compelled to do them, because, as the movie goes, with great power comes great responsibility. And in fact, that is an actual quote from the original comic, from Amazing Fantasy number 15, which was the first Spider-Man comic, and not Spider-Man number 1. And by the way, when we went to a Best Buy, we picked up some stuff at Best Buy, and one of the things they had on a table was a reprint of Spider-Man number 3, which was the first Dr. Octopus comic book. And it was interesting reading that, and it was like basically one penny with any purchase. So, but we enjoyed reading that because we looked at the difference between how things were written. And that was, I think, like 63, 64 was when that came out. But at any rate, Spidey is a reluctant hero. That's what made him popular in the 60s. I mean, if you look at the superheroes that were around back then, you know, there was still Superman and Batman and all that stuff. And they had basically, I watched a documentary about comics where they had a big glut of superheroes after Superman and Batman came out and became very, very popular. But Superman and Batman are people who are not quite human. I mean, Batman is human, but Batman has a kind of superhuman tendency and obsession that goes beyond anything mere mortals can do. And Superman, of course, isn't even human. He's Kryptonian. But Spider-Man, it was very human. And you really, really reflects that in this film much more. Even more than the first one. And Peter Parker's trials and tribulations touch us in a way that, you know, Batman and Superman wouldn't. Because Batman and Superman don't have trials and tribulations. Oh, they might be close to being beat up by an enemy, but you can't imagine Bruce Wayne or Clark Kent having any really serious personal problems. Mr. Kent's only real worry is about whether or not Lois is going to go out on a date with him. My throat's really dry. I apologize. But anyway, Spidey is the kind of hero that we identify with. And that's why it's so successful. We really need a hero like that. And we don't need somebody who has a lot of false bravura, false courage. And that's what George Bush displays. He'll get up there on an airline character, an aircraft carrier, and pretend like he's Mr. Big Tough Guy. But I bet when the chips fall, when the shit hits the fan, he's a huge coward. And I think the big thing about Fahrenheit 9/11 is the showing of how he just sat there for 7 minutes trying to figure out what to do. Does anybody remember when the Challenger blew up? Is anybody old enough listening out there to remember that? I remember that very clearly. I didn't see it live on television. I remember when I first heard about it. I was in Japan at the time, so we didn't get live stuff from the States. And I saw it later on a repeat on the Armed Forces television network. And I remember they showed a picture of Reagan. Now, remember, people forget that her name was Krista McAuliffe. Yeah, she was a school teacher who was going to be on the shuttle. And Reagan was in a classroom, and they were looking at the launch, and, you know, the Challenger blew up, and the look on Reagan's eyes was like, oh, shit, and they dragged his ass out of that classroom. You know, he left immediately. This wasn't necessarily a threat to national security. This wasn't the United States under attack. This was just a bad screw-up where the space shuttle blew up. It affected me, actually. It was one of those things that really affected me so much that I can remember clearly. People who are old enough to remember Kennedy's assassination and even older, the ones who remember the death of Franklin Roosevelt, for many of them, there was a situation where when they first heard the news, it shocked them shocked their memory. It shocked them so much that they remember that and have kept the memory and can call it back as if it almost happened. And that's the way that was for me. That's the way somebody human and somebody real reacts. And here's Mr. Bush sitting there in a schoolroom reading a book about a pet goat for 7 minutes after he's been told that we are under attack, basically. And, of course, Mr. Bush knew about the first plane hitting the World Trade Center before the thing even started. Sorry. My throat is getting very dry today. I apologize again. But anyway, Mr. Bush already knew about the first plane hitting the tower before he went into the schoolroom. So he decided to continue on with his little photo op. You know, it's interesting because Molly Ivins, the great writer out of Texas, said that whenever George Bush is talking to school kids, watch out. Because something nasty usually happens when he's talking to school kids. It happened a lot in Texas. She wrote that long before September 11th. So you wonder what was going through that guy's head. I mean, realistically, he should have got the hell out of there immediately. But, of course, you know, by the time he did get out of there, he went willy-nilly all over the place. And that was one of the main things for Fahrenheit 9/11. Is that the kind of hero we want? You know, if Mr. Bush had taken some decisive action and called everybody together, and, you know, Democrats and Republicans, say, look, this is something that goes above and beyond politics, man, I'd be all for him. I'd be ready to go over there and push that lever. There wouldn't be a question about the election at this point if he went about things the right way. But he didn't go about things the right way. He just started going around saying anybody who disagrees with anything I do is an enemy to the country. And that's bullshit. That is absolute and total bullshit. I can't put it any plainer than that. I mean, it's our right to say something is wrong. I mean, and again, I would have been for the Iraq war if it had been done properly. And how it's done properly is you give the United Nations inspectors time to do their job. You find out if there's clear evidence that that there's an actual threat from the guy. Excuse me. My throat. I'm sorry. My throat's just really fucking up today. You'll have to live with that. if there was clear evidence that there was a definite threat, I'm all for it. I'm not a pacifist. Bomb the shit out of them. Take them out before they hurt us. But there was never any indication of that. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Iraq has never attacked us. Iraq has never even claimed that they were going to attack us. All the battles that we fought with Iraq have been fought in Iraq. And now we have over 800 U.S. soldiers dead, countless thousands of innocent Iraqis. And again, I want to point out, I bet you any money, if you were to talk to a regular Iraqi person, you would find how much they are just like us in certain sense. I mean, obviously, they follow a different religion and they have different specific customs, but for the most part, they're no different than us. They want the same things we want. They want to be able to live their lives in peace and freedom, to worship God the way they want to worship it, and not to bother anybody else. They weren't totally responsible for Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein took force. And those who were supporting him, supported him for a reason. He had a very there was a very nationalistic sense to that. And he was a corrupt leader who deserved to be run out, but so do a lot of other corrupt leaders deserve to be run out. We're right now supporting people who are just as corrupt, and in some cases even more corrupt, than Saddam Hussein. We are right now not bombing countries that are a clear threat, who do have weapons of mass destruction. And it's just, to me, disingenuous to say, let's go after Iraq. And I mean, it's like the U.S. military should not be used as a personal vendetta, as a tool for a personal vendetta of any president. Now, if Mr. Bush had gotten together and put together a plan, again, included Democrats along with it, because, you know, after Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt reached out to Republicans and included them in his decision-making. And he understood that what had happened in the war that we were fighting against fascism in Japan and fascism in Germany and in Italy was bigger than petty politics. But to the Bush people, politics is everything. Politics is absolutely everything. And now we get word that Mr. Bush and his people are pestering Pakistan to come up with a high-level target on or around the Democratic Convention, which is at the end of this month. And they're also talking about contingency plans in case we have to cancel the elections. If they cancel the elections, I'm canceling the Republican Party. They ought to not only be kicked out of office, but they ought to be run into jail. They ought to be run out of the fucking country if they cancel these elections. We have never canceled elections in this country on a federal level. Never. We didn't do it during the fucking Civil War. When I don't know how many states were part of the Confederacy. When all of those states had seceded and gone out, we still held a fucking election. So don't give me no shit about canceling elections. And anybody who talks seriously about that ought to be slapped in the face. It's fucking ridiculous. You don't do that shit. But these people are fucking insane. They're just fucking insane. I don't know why I got off on that fucking angry rant. Damn, that pisses me off. Let me take a quick little break while I try to get my throat settled out. And I'll finish up with another rant, a shorter rant, because we're about 10 minutes away from shutting this whole thing down for the evening. Sam, play us out.
The Cup of Joe Radio Show will be right back.
And we're back on the Cup of Joe Radio Show for a short time. I want to play this clip from Howard Stern's show. And this is actually a little dated, but it's not too bad. This is when he had Simon Rosenberg from the New Democratic Network on, talking about a poll of Mr. Stern's listeners. And Mr. Stern, who was I'm not a big fan of Mr. Stern myself, and he was relatively neutral about politics. He hit basically both parties, but he's been going after Mr. Bush pretty strongly lately. So let's listen to this. This is from Howard Stern's show about a week or so ago.
I could try and get him back on. I thought you wanted to do stuff to Bowie and then speak to him. I can get him back on right now if you want.
Well, I was back timing up till 8:15 because I saw it was on the schedule.
Okay, I'll get him on now.
He can explain this whole thing to us about our audience.
Poll and what it shows about the people who listen.
Yeah, this cat's name is Simon Rosenberg. And he's
with Did he take the poll?
No. They're the group. It's called the New Democratic Network. And they're the group that hired someone to, you know, an independent survey people to find out, do we make a difference in the election, the upcoming election?
So it is their survey. They bought it.
Yeah, yeah. But in other words, they went to some independent polling firm. It's not like they did the survey. They don't know how to
do a
survey.
They're not pollsters.
Right.
They commissioned.
Yeah. So they found out that our audience is really having a difference in this upcoming election. Mm-hmm. Like it's no BS. Like, you know, everyone says we're a bunch of tools. But meanwhile, turns out, like, everyone listens to us, especially a lot of dudes who are swing voters and born-again Christians.
Yeah.
Who are now
that
thinking
amazing.
Of changing their vote. Oh, there's Simon Rosenberg. Hold on. Simon, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good to speak to you.
It's great to be on the show with the king of the swing. You used to be the king of all media.
King of the swing, I like that.
King of the swing.
Simon, help me out with this. So your group is called the New Democratic Network.
Yes.
And you guys got curious. You said, okay, Stern's on there, you know, rabble-rousing, screaming about Bush, and Bush is a jerk. Is it having an effect on the election? So I guess you guys hired pollsters to go out and figure out who is in our audience and whether or not it has an effect.
Yeah.
All right, so what did you find?
What we found is that, you know, the listeners of your show could play a very, very important role in this election, and that what you're doing could literally determine who the next leader of the free world is, because there are a lot of undecided voters. You're reaching them. One out of six of every likely voter in America listens to your show.
You know what's funny, Simon? I swear to you, I didn't get into this whole political thing. Every once in a while, the show has gotten political.
Yep.
And we backed Pataki, we backed Whitman, and people said, oh, you switched now, you're a Democrat. I said, I'm an independent. I have voted in my past for Republican candidates and Democrat. I always vote for the best guy. I happen to think John Kerry is the best guy right now.
Yep.
And I always felt my audience, I mean, it was proven in two elections that we made a difference mm-hmm. in who got elected in two different states. And, you know, I see, like, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, Simon, and I see the Sean Hannitys. They preach to the converted.
Yep.
You know, I believe our audience is open-minded. I was just waiting for some proof of this, and it seems like you found it. But go ahead with the survey.
Well, and by the way, the survey can be read by all your listeners at our website at NewDem, newdem.org. You can pull it down and read about the influence that your community can have on this election. And Howard, I just want to say I'm from New York. I started listening to you a long time ago. I'm an old fan, and I just want to say that I think it's what you're doing and helping people get focused on how much their vote counts and how they can make a difference. You've proven it before, but this time the stakes are really high.
I think the stakes are higher than they've ever been before. I think that George Bush... Hey, have you seen Fahrenheit 9/11?
I'm going to see it Thursday.
Wait till you see this film. I mean, it is unbelievable. And don't, you know, and I say to my audience, don't take the film's word even for it. Just start reading about this.
Start reading, yeah, there's plenty to read.
Go to our website. We've got tons of material about Bush and what's going on with the environment, what's going on with stem cell research,
what's
going
on
in the war.
The economy.
Yeah, and the fact that you're not any safer. The war on terrorism isn't even being fought.
Oh, guess what? 4th of July is coming up. Guess what we got? A new terror alert.
Yeah, well, And Bush is somehow convincing people that he's keeping you protected. He issued the terror alert, and then you go, oh, look, nothing happened. He's protecting us.
He took care of us.
So what about my audience? Did it say in the survey that a lot of born-again Christians are in the audience?
No.
Oh, I thought I saw that in the Times on Sunday.
I think that your listeners are swing voters. I mean, I think a lot of the folks are just like you, Howard. I mean, they vote for the best candidate, and they're not beholden to either party. They let today, I think, in part because of what you're doing, they like Kerry more than Bush. And when you get into the battleground states, the margin gets even bigger by 20 points.
What are the battleground states?
Well, there are 18 states. New York and New Jersey and Connecticut aren't among them, but
right.
It's Midwest and the Southwest
Well, we're on in Detroit. We're on in Philadelphia. Is Pennsylvania one of them?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida.
Michigan, Florida.
We used to be on a lot in Florida. We're still on. We have some presence in Florida. But, hey, by the way, I'm having a press conference tomorrow. I'm going to make a big announcement. I would like you to tune in tomorrow, Simon. I think you'll be very interested. Gary, what time is the press conference? I think you might be interested in what I have to say.
Baba Booey.
I'd love to listen. And Howard, listen, I agree with you. I mean, I think that Clear Channel and what's happening with the Bush administration, I think, you know, the FCC has not applied their standards evenly across the board.
They have not.
I think you have been singled out by the Republicans for speaking your mind, and I think this is something that's un-American and something we just can't stand for. So one of the reasons I wanted to come on your show today is just to say that, you know, I want to thank you for your fighting hard for your beliefs and for what I think is intrinsically American. And
hey, Simon.
We're big fans of you, Dan.
And I want to thank you because I know how hard you work, and I want to thank you for doing this survey, which proved to all these nitwits that our audience matters, and it's a factor in what is going to happen in the next election. It makes me feel good because I'm so tired, Simon, of reading these articles where they say, oh, Howard's audience, a bunch of idiots. Meanwhile, we have evidence that these, I mean, there was an article the other day, the Fortune 500 top CEOs are more likely to listen to this show than to the Bloomberg radio networks for financial advice.
Five
and
times.
I can't understand how they could say such a large audience could be all idiots.
Right.
They're five times more likely to listen to you.
Yeah. I mean, and then your survey did so much in terms of credibility that I really do thank you. And I support John Kerry. I'm not only anti-Bush, I support John Kerry. I think he's a wise...
You're not just voting against something, you're voting for something.
I think he'd make some wise decisions. I think he can bring back some sort of true coalition.
Yep.
I think he might be able to go back and sort of look at a lot of situations and make some wise decisions, make some good appointments to the court, not threaten the woman's right to choose. He's going to be the guy who I think will get us back on track of finding some of these corporations for pollution.
And getting the deficit under control again. This is ridiculous how we're totally living on credit. The country's living on credit.
We're borrowing tremendous money from Japan and China like we've never seen before. And someone's going to have to pay.
What are we doing borrowing money from China?
Yes, Simon. What are we doing?
Well, listen, I think, Howard, you're right. I mean, I and Robin, I think we can do better as a country than we've been doing. I think you all are helping lead the way.
Thank you.
I mean, look, the millions of jobs lost, millions of people without health care, historic budget deficits, rolling back environmental laws, you know, billions promised for our poor schools and not delivered by this guy.
Simon,
the,
we're going to...
big mess in Iraq. Clearly, with your, you know, we can do better, guys.
We're going to... My audience... And I truly believe they are unified in this, especially with what this George Bush appointed Colin Powell's son to the head of the FCC. The guy squandered $2 billion of taxpayers' money.
$2 billion.
$2 billion. He's after me, like all hell-bent on getting me. And my audience, for the most part, is going to help the cause. And I thank you for doing that survey. I truly do.
Well, I hope we can come back. We're big fans. And just let us know what we can do down here.
Thanks, Simon.
I'll be listening tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Simon. I really appreciate you calling in.
Okay.
All right. That's
bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks. Simon Rosenberg, the guy who actually commissioned that survey.
What did we learn?
We learned that our audience isn't a bunch of idiots.
Oh.
And we learned that our audience is diverse, and they're willing to make a decision on who to vote for without being a Republican or Democrat.
That the audience is the swing vote.
That's right. That's what we learned. Because that's what I got out of it.
Thank you.
And that about wraps it up here on the Cup of Joe radio show. Once again, I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio. And I invite you once more to read my blog, cupofjoe.blogspot.com, cupofjoe.blogspot.com, and leave a little message in the comments section to say you listened to the show and whether you liked it or not. And you can also email me at joevec@bellsouth.net. Once again, let me thank rantradio.com and all my other stations that play me. And also listen to my Audio Hell show on Cam Mafia Radio. That's on Saturdays from 4 to 6. So until next time, this is Joe Vecchio signing off. Bye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.